morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. For the record, I'm Ken Masters, representing Ms. Stone and Ms. Carosi. I'll try to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
Keep your eye on the clock, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. In its final dispositive order denying remand on appeal here, the Court acknowledges our number on the amount of controversy, but says that Olympic Steamship fees, but adds the Olympic Steamship fees, that fee determination is clear legal error, and the District Court appears to have worked backwards from the $5 million requirement under CAFA to the jurisdictional amount by just simply filling in the gap without any evidence that attorney's fees could ever reach that number, that very high number. On the contrary, Olympic Steamship under Washington law is strictly limited to coverage questions. The coverage question here was dismissed in the Pierce County Superior Court on a 12B6. It's a very simple question. And
did the court anticipate that the coverage issues may have to be relitigated again in federal court, and so therefore the anticipated but unaccrued attorney's fees for that portion would then have to be included under Olympic Steamship?
What the court said in its order, the court held no hearings and heard no argument here through any of this proceeding, so it's a little hard to tell, but what the court said in its order was it was unclear why the judge granted the 12B6. There's a lot of things that are unclear, and one of them is, what is the coverage question? It seems to us that if GEICO is going to argue that there's a coverage question, they should have to identify that. They have the burden of proof here, obviously. Identify the question, show how it will result, and then put on some evidence under ABARA of what those fees will be. In this case, there's no such evidence that number of fees could ever reach that level. And it can't under Washington law, because Olympic Steamship, we've cited cases like McGreevy and Dayton, Washington Supreme Court case, that says clearly you have to segregate the fees for the coverage question, which was litigated for under $10,000 at the beginning of this case, from any other fees that might be recoverable for the class action. So if you segregate those, that number is so small that it could never fill the gap between our number that the court accepted and the $5 million requirement. In addition, there just simply is no
evidence. Of course, I'm amazed and surprised that legal fees could ever be less than $1.3 million.
Well, Your Honor, we have actually litigated this question against a number of insurers for a very small amount of money. It's just a very clear coverage question. It's all damages that we're legally entitled to recover.
Higher than 1.3, but not due to coverage litigation or dispute. It's all for claims-based.
Sure. The total attorney's fees, which would come out of the common fund, not be added to it, but come out of it, those fees could be high. But that would be part of our same amount in controversy that we've suggested and that it appears the trial court accepted. Those would come out of that. They wouldn't be added to it. So sure, attorney's fees for a multi-million dollar class action could be over $1 million. Absolutely, we would never argue that's not true. But that's for the underlying claim, not the
cover. Comes out of the total raise, and it's only these added attorney's fees that matter here.
Right, and we can't dispute, the case law says that you can add fees where there is a clear legal basis under Washington law or under state law for a separate legal basis. The only separate legal basis that's ever been identified is the Olympic Steamship. And Olympic Steamship, your honors may know, itself says when an insurer has to sue to get coverage for which it paid, you have to give the fees for that coverage dispute, because otherwise you're not getting the full benefit of the insurance that you paid for. That is what Olympic Steam is. It's a very narrow rule that just allows you to recover just the coverage amount. And McGreevy directly says you must segregate that and you can only recover that. So there is no evidence in this. And actually the trial judge's orders, as you look, the district court's judges, if you look at his orders, what he keeps saying is, and he says it in writing many times, the total fees in this case could be over the amount, and it could be in seven figures. But there's never the link. How could the coverage action, which is a very simple, small thing, that he says, by the way, at SER 211, he says, the plaintiffs are right. I could dispose of the coverage question very easily. But it's true. It's just absolutely clear under Washington law there's coverage here. And remember that I'd also like to talk about, in our complaint, because, of course, we're supposed to look at that complaint, the original document, for this purpose, under CAFA. We said GEICO insurance with Washington policies issued in Washington. So it's only in Washington. I'm looking at SER 9 right now, paragraph 5.3 and 5.4. Washington insured, where GEICO determined the loss to be covered under its underinsured motorist coverage. So the very definition of the class in the original complaint says if there's a coverage question, they're not in the class. Only those that GEICO determined the loss to be covered under the underinsured motorist. So we don't really understand how the trial court, the court did find a coverage question here, although no one has ever articulated what it is. Okay.
So then, you're asking us to do, though, I just want to make sure I understand, is to remand to the district court to make a evidentiary-based calculation as opposed to what was presently on the record.
Your Honor, your review is de novo, and GEICO has the burden of proof. We think that you remand for a remand to the trial court. They failed to meet their burden of proof, and it is their burden to sustain jurisdiction in the federal courts.
So that's what I wanted to find. Yeah. So you don't think we should send it back for recalculation? You think we should just send it back saying, this under CAFA, this does not meet the requirements.
That's right, Your Honor. Look at the record. Did they put on evidence that would support a seven-figure fee award? Because the trial court, as I say, accepted our lower CAFA-mounted controversy. Did they put on evidence? Remember, and it is very telling.
Can we tell what the district court was thinking here? Because the district court says, in a related and similar class action, the court concluded that the potential for actual fees incurred could easily exceed the upper bound of $1.6 plus some change million dollars, relying on the district court's experience in the McGraw case. As I understand the record, there was no segregation between coverage and claims issues in McGraw either. So it seems to me that the error in this case, if there is one, is in the failure to acknowledge and potentially segregate fees under Steamship Olympic between
coverage
versus claims. And so shouldn't the district court have an opportunity to do that in the first instance? You may be right that coverage disputes might not approach the $1.3 million to cover the gap, but that's the district court's role in the first instance, isn't it?
I certainly understand what you're saying. I would like to explain what happened in McGraw so it's clear. In McGraw, the GEICO said that the fees in that case, not this case, that case, could be that number, okay? And the judge said, oh, well, then you must have known that from the time of the complaint. And he sent the case back to Pierce County. McGraw's in Pierce County Superior Court now, okay? He used their number, which was just, came out of thin air, and he said, well, if that's what you think the fees are, I'm sending it back because you could have known that from the outset, right? So that number wasn't really established on evidence that we presented or they presented. It was a number that was just basically you admitted that's the number, so I'm sending the case back to Pierce County Superior Court. I don't believe that it meets a bar to pull a number from a different case that was never established by evidence, put it in here, stick it in to fill the gap and say, oh, look, we're over the, that could never work. And unless GEICO has put into this record now sufficient evidence to show that there possibly could be an Olympic Steamship Award, which really is inconceivable of in seven figures, unless they have evidence of that, then they failed to meet their burden, and you should remand back to the Superior Court, which is where this case really belongs. This isn't a proper federal case.
There's another issue or potential area of additional factual finding, and I want to see how you respond to that. You proposed a number compensatory damages, and GEICO proposed a number, and the difference is about $700,000 or so that the district court never really resolved. The district court accepted the lower figure for purposes of this case, determining CAFA jurisdiction, because the district court thought that any potential attorney's fees would more than easily cover the gap. Shouldn't we give the district court an opportunity to resolve the difference between the two proposed figures? Because it may be, of course, that would then lower the amount of Olympic steamship fees that could be included as part of the CAFA calculation.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, none of that has ever been tied to Olympic steamship. So I want to be clear about none of it is tied to Olympic steamship. But there was, GEICO came up with an original number that's way high. It's 40% higher than our number. Okay, we showed the district court, put on evidence that it's 40. They're over inclusive on our basic statement in the complaint of our class.
But
we
showed
they were 40%.
Did the district court resolve that, or was it that the district court said, I don't need to resolve that because any attorney's fees could easily cover that?
Well, we believe that we established on the record, we don't have a burden of proof here, but we believe that we established on the record that they're 40% too high, and so that's why he accepted the number at the end. Now, in their appellate briefing here, they've raised for the first time a number that doesn't hit the CAFA number. It's a page four, about 40 or 41 of their responsive brief. They've done a new calculation that doesn't.
You're saying that was never presented to the district court?
It was presented and then stricken by the district court. And while we ask you to consider evidence that they struck, that the judge struck of ours, and we brought that motion, GEICO didn't do that. So that's been stricken. But their own math is suggesting they can't hit the CAFA without the attorney's fees. In that case, being hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, the only evidence in this record, and we ask that you do consider our evidence on this, shows that it would be that this exact issue was litigated for less than $20,000. If you don't have any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Dan Goldfein. I'm here on behalf of GEICO in general. There are actually two findings of fact that the trial court made below that you'll have to address and, frankly, reverse finding clearly erroneous. We've talked a lot about the $1.34 million here.
What was that based on?
The $1.34 million was based largely on the judge's experience trying to predict how this case would work out. And GEICO is going to challenge.
So tell me the case that you rely on that says for the determination of jurisdictional limit, a judge, without holding any kind of evidentiary hearing on this issue, can say, well, I've been around a long time, and I think this is what it would amount to. Tell me the case that says that's permissible.
Yeah, I think under Ibarra, and the logic and express language of La Crosse and Ibarra, they say that there is an unreported case in the Ninth Circuit from 2002 that squarely says when trying to predict the future attorney's fees or emotional distress damages, that's the Nasseria case. That case squarely addresses that issue and permits it.
Didn't, to the extent the district court indicated the basis for his prediction, he relied on another case where there had been this, your adversary says, glomming together of two different things, and plus, in that other case, it really was not a finding of the court. It was just a assuming for the sake of argument it's X, I still remand. So what about that?
Well, I think that the most important thing for this particular case, he went back and looked at McGraw, and frankly, there is about 20 auto insurance-related cases that Judge Settle has touched or has been looking at. He went back and looked at those and used his experience and came to the conclusion. And if I may, just the posture here is a little bit different than what plaintiff's counsel has suggested. The court did make a finding of fact that there was more than $6 million worth of damages at risk in this case. That finding of fact was based on Rule 56-like evidence, depositions, declaration evidence, exhibits. They made that finding of fact. Post that finding of fact, they moved twice for reconsideration. In the context of moving for reconsideration, the judge said, okay, I'll accept. He didn't agree. He didn't make a finding of fact that their damages analysis based on their interpretation of the complaint, their downsizing of the complaint in order to fit it outside of CAFA, he didn't agree that that was right. His original finding of fact stayed there. He just said, to be candid, he just said, I don't need to address this issue because I know, based on my experience and based on the submission here, also supplemented by the evidence of both parties, as part of the second motion for reconsideration that the plaintiffs filed, supplemented by evidence of both parties, that this case will, in fact, have fees that are more than $1.3 million, making it above the $5 million thresholds, even if they were to accept the smaller number, which is dependent on redefining the class in this case. So, as I said, there's two finding of facts. So $1.3 million that you'd have to reverse and find was clearly erroneous, and the $6 million plus from the original motion to remand on damages. Absent that, the case has to be affirmed, and absent both of those findings. I'd like to address the segregation issue. Plaintiffs suggest that this is just an easy case, that coverage isn't at dispute here. I think what the model for this court to look at is the King County case. King County case was fully litigated to fruition, challenging throughout coverage-related issues, and the entirety of fees were applied there. There wasn't a segregation. And as at this posture, in determining what potentially is the amount at stake for this court to determine, or for the district court to determine, that's the case. You know, GEICO, it's not only the general coverage language, as the court addressed, saying there could be differences in the interpretation of the policy, but it's also whether or not coverage was triggered by the two named plaintiffs or the class reps, or excuse me, the absent class members, or whether or not the damages suggested, the injury suggested, not the damages, the injury suggested is the type of injury that's cognizable under Washington law. Those issues are going to be litigated at class cert, with the pending class cert motion, through regular discovery, through dispositive motions. They're going to be litigated pretrial motions. They're going to be litigated at trial. And if GEICO loses, like GEICO's going to litigate at appeal the coverage issues. It's not just this simple case that they can throw out that. And again, the standard here is not what was likely resolved, as the plaintiff suggested here. The standard is what is potentially the amount at stake, the reality at stake here. And that is, in fact, the reality. Now, I'd like to address three misstatements made in their briefs, if I have a couple minutes here. The first misstatement...
Can I ask you a question before you get to that? Even if you're right that the potential fees at stake could easily be in excess of $1.3 million, or let's say it's $1.8 million, what amount of that is attributable to coverage versus claims? That's a determination that has to be made by the district court. And as I understand the district court's order 9 remand and also the order on reconsideration, the district court seemed to put it all in the same pot. So we don't know on this record, do we, which portion the district court thought.
Well, I think that
on a projected basis could be tied solely to coverage issue, which is what Olympic Steamship is all about. Because the Washington courts tried to segregate if you're able to do that. And in this case, where coverage is more of a legal issue and then the rest seem to be more factual issues, it seems to me that the district court could segregate it. And I didn't see any attempt to do so on this record.
You're absolutely correct that there is no attempt to segregate out on this record. But I think that that's a misreading of the way the Olympic Steamship and the McGreevy exception applies. The McGreevy exception is the narrow, and this is the flip of what the plaintiff said. If you read the cases, and I can't do the who shot who here. You'll have to go back to the briefs. Their brief at 38 for 39 and our brief at 20 to 24 to get to this. But the exception under Olympic Steamship is very narrow. It's the amount of fees exception. And it's the rule under Olympic Steamship, the general rule, if a litigant, if named class members or the absent class members, if they have to fight it to win, they get their fees. And it's only if there's a separate, and the only case under Washington law is if there's a separate distinct hearing for damages only post the coverage resolution and all liability resolution here. So in fact, the court did what's correct here, which was not do the segregation promoted by plaintiffs below to separate out what he was guessing at it. The way this case may, again, under the standard that this court has to apply here, the way that this case may be played out is that GEICO fights coverage, the aspects of coverage, from today to appeal. And that's, the judge made his ruling based on that. He says that, you know, in essence. And I don't think under Dart Cherokee, district courts are required to have a full-blown evidentiary hearing on every issue. They're expected to take evidence and understand what's taking place here, but they're also not expected to divorce the reality at stake. That's the language the Ninth Circuit uses quite frequently, and that's what took place below. The segregation does not have to occur to come to what might be at stake for the parties here. The other thing I would like to say on the common fund evidence that was presented, that's the type of evidence that might be available at this point in time. And again, there seems to be some divorce here that the common fund evidence, where courts say that these are reasonable attorney's fees, somehow doesn't reflect what might be at stake at this case. I mean, you have to have earned the common fund evidence. The court has to make that finding. And these cases either get resolved, these particular series of cases brought by the same lawyers here, either get resolved by defendants winning on a dispositive motion or appeal, or there's a settlement. Getting all the way to trial, there's not an example for the court. So the trial court did what he could do, and to challenge that based on some sort of segregation that's not required under Washington law, frankly, I don't think is fair to the trial court. Getting back to the three misstatements in the record, the first misstatement has to do with the complaint, and they repeated that misstatement here. The initial and amended
complaint. You want courts of appeals to be fair to district courts? Never heard of that.
We can hope. Both the plaintiff's initial amended complaint expressly provide, and this paragraphs 5.3 and 5.5 and can be found in the excerpts of record, our excerpts of record at 9 and 26 to 27, that the class, quote, includes all insureds without use of their vehicles for a day or more at any point in time during the entire period that they were without their use of the vehicle for which GEICO didn't fully pay them. To get to their smaller number, and this is why the $6.4 number is the $6 million number, is the finding of fact is supported by substantial evidence. To get to that number, they have to change the allegation. They have to modify it. And this court's decision in Roth, the Supreme Court's decision in Knowles, clearly bars their ability to do that, to maneuver around CAFA diversity jurisdiction. The second misstatement is in their burden-shifting argument. They complain that the judge shifted the burden. That's not what took place here. And their argument's based on basically, they don't even ellipse it out. They just omit the two following sentences that the judge said. The judge took evidence on the $6 million of damages. He took the evidence of Mr. Antonacci's declaration. He took it. Mr. Antonacci explained how he got to the class size. The judge accepted that. And I'll quote the trial court. Quote, more importantly, Geico's Antonacci specifically addressed the failure to exclude these insureds from his search, Antonacci Declaration, paragraph 14, open parenthetical, the exclusion requires a claim-by-claim analysis. Plaintiffs failed to counter this evidence. As I understand the way things are supposed to work, and obviously you all know better than me, is that if one party presents evidence, the other side fails to counter it, that's the end. And that's what on the $6 million plus for damages, absent any fees, that's what the court found. And then the last misstatements, which is at page 13 of their brief having to do with the state court ruling, they seem to walk a bit away from this misstatement. They misstate that the state court resolved the coverage issue. That's not the case. The state court denied a motion to dismiss. There could be many grounds. And frankly, the trial court thought maybe Geico didn't brief it very well. The reality of it is there could be multiple interpretations. The plaintiffs, at that point in time, the named plaintiffs was only Stone. Carosi hadn't joined the case. They might not have, as alleged, there might be a factual dispute as to whether they triggered coverage or whether they suffered a cognizable injury. These are the issues that are going to be tried in this case. And to suggest that coverage was resolved or easily resolved is belied by, I believe it's page 26 of their brief, where they say, oh, it's open for summary judgment dispute. Plaintiffs concede that, in fact, coverage is going to be litigated at summary judgment. We think this dispute, if not resolved at class cert for a variety of reasons, that Geico will be litigating it through summary judgment, trial, and appeal.
Well, it seems like the district court thought the coverage issue could be easily resolved as well.
I don't believe there's a finding of fact of that.
Well, this is the order on the motion for reconsideration. At the time of removal, plaintiffs asserted a claim for denial of coverage, which opens the door for recovery of attorney's fees under Olympic Steamship. While plaintiffs are correct that the court could easily dispose of any coverage issue or at the conclusion of the matter limit such fees, the potential for the award, treating it all together, essentially could easily exceed the amount required to cover the gap in CAFA jurisdiction because it's highly contested action. So that seems to me the district court clearly expressed its view there.
I guess, we have an apple and orange. He's already at the posture of he's decided the finding of fact that there's more than $6 million. He's gotten a second motion for reconsideration. And all he's saying that they could possibly rewrite. Absolutely. That's what litigation's about. Both sides could be possibly right that, in fact, coverage could be resolved. But again, coverage is a broad issue under Washington law and under Steamship. And I, again, point you to, I've exceeded my limit, if I may finish the answer to the question. I point you to King County in that case, and how it plays out in reality is that all the issues, the coverage and the coverage-related issue, whether there's a trigger to coverage, whether the injury sustained is a cognizable injury under state law for coverage, those are issues that get fought out through a lengthy trial. And if plaintiffs were to proceed, it's a bit perverse that I have to argue this. If they were to proceed, they would certainly argue that they were entitled to all of their attorney's fees.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I think you've got some additional time for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just three quick points. First of all, this is not a downsizing. The Geico continues to argue we're downsizing. Our initial complaint, which I read to you, says the class is this big. For instance, in the Knowles case, Standard Fire Supreme Court case, there was a class that was this big, $7 million or something. And what the plaintiffs did was say, oh, we'll let go of the $2 million of that. They didn't say we're not bringing all those claims. They said we'll let go. And the Supreme Court said you can't do that because the class hasn't been established. We're starting here. We're saying only people that GEICO determined the loss to be covered under the uninsured most covered would be included. So if there is a coverage dispute, they would be excluded from the class, right? That's the first thing. Counsel read to you the second part. He said, who received payment for substitute transportation, he was reading, from GEICO during the entire period that they were without use of the vehicle. He said, we misrepresented that. He left out the first part of the sentence, which is excluded from the class. Okay, that's paragraph 5.4, are those who receive payment for substitute transport. I mean, it's exactly, we are being very honest with the court about what that is. I also want to point out two other things. First of all, what the judge did here would basically destroy the CAFA $5 million limit. If you can just say, okay, whatever the number is, and he did appear to accept our number at the end, I'm going to fill that gap. If you can work backwards, that's not the kind of reasoning that I think a logical reasoning requires. They require, this court requires evidence to support that gap filling that doesn't exist in this case. And then the last thing I want to say is, since the class only includes people who GEICO has determined to be covered, they've actually paid the UIM claims in this case, okay? It would certainly be the height of bad faith. And the reason you've never heard to this moment GEICO tell you what the coverage dispute is because it would be the height of bad faith for them to turn around now, having paid the claims, and claim there's a coverage dispute. And that opens up a totally different can of worms, which I believe would be a separate cause of action under IFCA and other Washington law for bad faith violation of their duties under their contract. This is a pure breach of contract claim. We say they breached, they said there's coverage, they didn't provide all the coverage available. That's all this is, and coverage is really a non-entity or non-issue here. Thank you very much.
All right, we've got the argument. Thank you very much, both sides. The matter is submitted for a decision.